Shares. Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is automatic, systematic, high dramatic. Not really, but it's electrifying, Doc. This is Motley Fool Money. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me as always, Dr. Nirban Mahanti. How are you, buddy?
Good day, Captain. How are you?
Do you like my grease open?
I like your no oil open.
Listeners can imagine us with leather jackets, John Travolta hair. I don't have hair. This is theatre of the mind, mate. Theatre of the mind. I have hair right now. I'm in a leather jacket. I'm on top of an old car. Olivia Newton-John off in the distance. That has some relevance to what we're talking about. There were no Teslas in Greece.
Oh, that's so sad.
We are going to talk about Tesla's electric results. So did they?
Yeah. Good, huh? Very electric.
We'll talk about Amazon's sales soar, but shares sink. Because I'm all about alliteration. Maya misleads, but no one cared. And, mate, got to get on Team Optimism. Property's back. It's happening.
It's like a dead cat bounce.
And we'll dip into the full mailbag. Let's get on with it.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, Tesla, your favourite. The Church of Elon, the company that is revolutionising the way we travel, at least in theory and hopefully. Shares were up, .1 carry the 17%. Overnight. So we're recording this on Friday morning. Now, you had some sense of that because in the US they have aftermarket trading and we knew that yesterday morning that shares were likely to be up a little bit or up a lot. 17%. You're a Tesla shareholder.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine you're feeling pretty good, but spare us the, take a victory lap if you want to, but more importantly, tell us what is going on with Tesla. Has it finally turned the corner?
Well, you know, Tesla never really needed to turn the corner, you know, because Teslas basically go straight and they go fast.
Well, they don't turn corners.
Well, they do. But, you know, and they turn, well, they turn corners automatically, right? It's got autopilot.
That's all right.
So, I mean, you know, this some of this result should have been expected because Tesla every quarter releases its quarterly delivery numbers, right? And they delivered... the delivery and production numbers and delivered like over like, you know, 97,000 cars.
In a quarter.
So, I mean, basically what's happening is it's pretty simple. I mean, more cars are being delivered of the same fixed cost base, largely fixed cost. But I mean, there's always variable cost for producing the car and things like that. There's batteries that go into the car. But this factory... There's staff in the factory. There's a factory line. You create more efficiency.
It's basically not quite software, but there is scale benefits when you get up these sort of volumes, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is a big fixed cost business, right? So, I mean, on the flip side is that if you don't sell enough, then you very quickly, you know, go into the reverse, right?
That's true.
Did you see that? I said reverse and drive.
Mate, I do the puns around here. Thanks very much.
So you know, the more cars, better mix resulted in more gross profit margins. Actually delivered a profit the third time in Tesla's history.
One-off profit or a beginning of a better trend profit?
Well, like, I mean, you know, here's what the bears will say, right? So, and Tesla is the most shorted stock in U.S. history. In U.S. history.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's a lot of people...
So most shorted in terms of the proportion of shares that are short sold, right?
Yes. So most shorted in the proportion of shares, and I mean, probably very high if you consider the fact that a lot of insiders own, you know, a significant chunk of the company. So the bears have been betting that, you know, there's competition around the corner. There's going to come. People are not going to buy Tesla cars. The margins are going to drop. And instead, what has happened, new margins drop every time they release a new product because, you know, there's a ramp-up cost involved. But once you get to scale, the margins start, you know, shining through. That's number one.
Right.
Number two is that, you know, Tesla is starting to, you know, among car manufacturers, there are not many car manufacturers who have got a deferred revenue line, right? Tesla's got a deferred revenue line, which is like something like $500 million sitting there to be recognized. And that's for the full self-driving suite. And you know, they release this thing called, you know, Advanced Someone in the U.S., which basically results in the car actually driving to you in a parking lot without a driver. So it's the first unsupervised driving.
So for those who are a certain age, you can pretty much think the Knight Industries 2000 kit itself of David Hasselhoff fame. You know, David Hasselhoff says, come on, Kit, come over here. And Kit drives over. You're telling me the future is finally here. Finally, I can drive Kit.
Yeah, the future is finally here. The future is now.
Oh, man, if it talked like Kit, I reckon that'd get people across the line. Tesla should license the Knight Rider voice,
yeah,
and get it to talk to you like the kit does, that I would actually buy one at that point. I think if it literally talked to me, I'd be there.
I don't know. Like, I mean, you know, the Tesla car farts. I did show you. It farts, right? So if you can't buy a car that farts, then I think, you know, you're missing a trick here. But anyways.
I want people in their heads to imagine the Knight Rider theme. I can hear it in my head right now. As you think about the Tesla coming to you, you press the auto summon button, whatever you have to do to make it turn up, and the Knight Rider theme is going in the background. That's exactly what you want, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, and then Tesla, I think, just going back to Tesla. So, you know, so the cash balance went up because they had free cash flow, you know. So now over a trailing 12-month period, they've got, what, $900 million plus, like $1 billion plus of free cash flow that has been generated. Margins are going up.
Mm-hmm.
The Model Y, which is the crossover, which is a really popular vehicle type in some parts of the world.
So crossover is a bit of a kind of a Yankee term. We're talking kind of like soft SUV, soft road.
Yeah, like crossover is a better term than an SUV. So an SUV is a bigger vehicle, right? And a crossover is somewhere between, I guess, an SUV and a car.
Okay, so like a kind of bulky station wagon-y thing?
It's, yeah, a little bit like a station wagon. Okay. I mean, you know, and that variant, I was going to call it, I call it a small SUV, basically.
Right.
Which is probably the right term.
Well, that's my thing, though. Exactly. I mean, it hasn't got off-road capability, so maybe off-road was a bad word, but yeah, small SUV, right?
I mean, neither the big SUV that they have got have off-road capabilities, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's
the
thing. You know, think of it like a Mazda CX-5 type of car.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
So that's coming, and that's going to come ahead. That's apparently coming ahead of schedule now, you know, because people have started spotting these trial version cars on the road.
Mm.
The China Model 3 is going to come, which is going to help in the China in terms of, you know, maintain margins, right? So I think a lot of things are happening. And then I think what people did not anticipate is how popular Model 3 has been. Model 3 has been really popular. They've held, you know, it has cannibalized some of their Model S sales, which is the bigger sedan. But in a way, Tesla has achieved exactly what they wanted to achieve, which is produce a car which is, you know, an expensive car, then produce a slightly less expensive car, then produce a slightly less expensive car, which has more volume. And yeah, there's a lot of things, you know, happening in the right direction, looking really good. And then maybe, you know, I think those bears who are, I think, counting on the company going bankrupt, I think they're going to have, you know, as I said, they're going to have short pants. Short shorts, they're going to not probably have their shorts, they're going to lose their short.
Right.
I think anyone who is on short Tesla on valuation grounds, I think, is in deep CAC.
Okay, so valuation seems to be kind of addressed. Some of the shorts are still not entirely sure Tesla has an ongoing business that stays debt or gets out of debt, stays profitable. Are you kind of prepared to call that effectively a failed short permanently now? Is there still risk of that? How, you know, I know you're a Tesla fan, but for the sake of some degree of balance, is there any kind of chance, probability, possibility of the bears being proven right just by circumstance? Or is this literally kind of in your mind the end of the short case? There's simply nothing left there.
Well, you know, there's a probability of always something happening. But anybody who I think understands a bit of technology, and, you know, I think the bigger problem with a lot of people who are shorting it is that I think they do not understand technology and how technology evolves. I think that's their biggest drawback.
Right.
Something like a recession could have an impact, like a worldwide global recession could have, you know, could be problematic for Tesla. But this is, in my opinion, probably the single, probably one of the few companies on the planet today that has optionality like no other. Right. So whether it is full self-driving, right? Now, Elon has a word.
I'm going to call that gently hyperbole, but I'll let you finish.
It's not hyperbole. So it's not hyperbole because, the you know, when Elon Musk would say that, you know, the game set match has happened for self-driving.
Right.
I cannot in any other imagine how another car company would get close to Tesla in terms of actually getting full self-driving. So they'd probably be the ones
But optionality, though, suggests more than, like, it's just different business lines or different opportunities, right? Like an Apple or an Amazon or a Google or a somebody else that has irons in many, many different fires. I would have thought that was optionality rather than, I agree with you, it's probably got a largely unassailable lead in self-driving. I didn't necessarily think that was optionality.
Yeah, so it's optionality in the sense that it has got leads in those markets that actually really matter.
Right.
So, Google has got leads in markets that probably do not matter. That's what happens to companies which become big and then, you know, forget about making these big bets.
Right.
Okay. So I think Tesla is a company that's got that has an opportunity in and a big lead in self-driving. It's got a big lead in energy storage.
Right.
It's got a big lead in renewable energy generation.
Mm.
and a big lead in EVs.
Okay, mate, where the hell is my Powerwall 3? Elon, like, make the cars, whatever. I've got a Powerwall 1 at home, and I paid a pretty penny for it. It was probably a bit of a silly purchase. I'm doing something for the environment. I'm saving a little bit of cash. I'm not entirely sure it's going to pay me back. The Powerwall 2 wasn't quite enough for Leap. I want my bloody Powerwall 3. Where is it?
Yeah, it's probably going to come maybe later, you know, in the next half. So what they basically said is that energy side of the business was starved because they don't have enough cells, right?
So they're basically putting all the available batteries in cars.
Yeah, everything that they had was going to make cars.
Okay.
That is slowly now starting to change. And you know, the solar, for example, had a big growth this year, this quarter.
Okay.
And they're saying energy is also going to have a big growth now, now that they've stabilized. So, and I think there's probably going to be a battery factory in China, which is going to help.
That's cool. And speaking of scale, I mean, that's the sort of thing that if they can get these things, I mean, it's a nice problem to have at some level when you can't meet demand. The problem with not meeting demand, of course, is you don't necessarily get to benefit from the scale you can otherwise deliver. So at some point, if they can build capacity at the same time as building demand, that's kind of the holy grail, right? It sounds like they're kind of doing that.
Yeah, I think so. I think that there's a lot of execution, good execution happening.
So I can tell Elon, you said the Powerwall 3 will be here next year.
Well, maybe, you know, like, I mean, you know, they're going to prioritize some things. I think more than the Powerwall, I think Powerwall to me is not that interesting.
Depends whether you want to save money on power.
Well, no. Powerwall is not interesting. To me, what's very interesting is grid-scale storage.
Yeah, right.
That's really interesting. And then, you know, Powerwall...
Do you mean technically interesting or interesting from a kind of company thesis perspective?
It's interesting from opportunity. It's a bigger market than the car market itself, right?
That's pretty cool.
And it's a market that's waiting to be disrupted in big ways. So I think, and I've always said this, that, you know, people are looking at the wrong thing. Mm. You know, what this company is doing basically is building battery technology. Mm. And that technology is going to be used in many different ways.
Well, to be fair, you've always said this is not so much a car company, but an energy company, right? That's been your line for quite a while.
Yeah, for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Right. And this was actually mentioned, this was noted in this call by Elon Musk, saying that, you know, look, people don't appreciate this, but, you know, we think that the energy market is actually bigger than the car market.
Right.
Right.
And does Tesla have the same sort of lead in energy? Like, is it, cars to some degree, like, they're pretty, what's the word? They're differentiated, right? You can make a car very, very different. Cars are kind of commodities, but you can create brands, you can create driving experience, you can create cars that fart. To your point, you can turn them into things that are differentiated by definition, right? At some point, I would speculate with my lack of knowledge that energy storage, while the tech is kind of different, you're kind of not really selling on you're not selling on the same sort of features. You haven't got the same brand benefit you've got with a car where you can say, but look, it's sleek, it looks cool, it comes to you when you call it. Like the stuff you add on a consumer level, if you're doing grid storage, I kind of don't imagine it's, you can't make it sexy in the same way, right? It's kind of like, okay, how much per kilowatt hour type stuff. Does Tesla have the same differentiation in energy, or is that a market where kind of, you know, a battery is a battery, a battery to some degree, it doesn't have the same degree of leadership?
So energy is not like, I mean, energy is not an area that, you know, it's not really computing science or, you know, software science that, you know, that I know much about. I know a little bit of energy because I did some work on a grid scale storage with a bunch of people and a bunch of companies, you know, so
we don't do expertise in this podcast. I just talk rubbish. I don't appreciate being shown up. Thank you.
I used to have some expertise. Maybe that's better.
I'm kidding. You make me look good, so I appreciate it.
So my understanding would be that there are, you know, like there'll be things like around energy density. There'll be things around how quickly you can, charge up, how quickly you can discharge, how you can maintain the battery's level cool, right?
Proprietary tech?
There's a lot of proprietary tech there. Like, I mean, to give an example, one of the things that they mentioned in the call is they did a software change and they're able to increase the range of existing fleet without changing the battery by up to 10%. Right.
It's very cool.
So that's very cool.
Literally, no. So there's a battery in a car and it drives out of the factory doing X.
Yeah.
And then because they've literally found a different way to tell the car and battery how to interact, they can now get 10% more range out of it.
So you buy today, any car that you buy basically is a depreciating asset it's basically getting worse over time.
Yeah.
You buy a Tesla, it basically gets better over time.
That is very cool.
So I mean, you know.
How cool. Imagine a traditional car, you drive it off the lot, it says you get 10 litres per 100 Ks, and all of a sudden they tell you, you know, 6 months later, actually, no, now it's 9 litres per 100 Ks.
Yeah.
Like it just, literally with nothing else, you don't bring it into the service center, you don't replace the engine, you don't have to upgrade the parts. They literally just say, guess what? You're going to use less fuel in future.
Yeah, so like, I mean, so I think that sort of idea and that technology is applicable at the grid scale as well. The other fact is that if you are the largest EV maker in the world and you are the leader in battery tech, then you know those scale benefits are going to also flow through to energy level storage as well, right? I mean, there are, and I'm not expecting any one company to win big. Like, I mean, like, you know, it's not a winners take all type of market, but the market itself is so huge that, you know, there might be like three or four, key participants at that scale, right? And if you can just partake in that market, that's enough to actually, you know, it's like the online e-commerce market. Like, it's a humongous market. So you can have hundreds of participants and each can have their own share.
Mate, you have taken me to a wonderful seg. Let's move on to e-commerce.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Tell you what, you're doing my job for me, mate. I'm going to be redundant very, very soon. This will be the Doc and Doc podcast in a couple of years. Mate, speaking of e-commerce and speaking of global dominance, Amazon, the big, big, big e-commerce behemoth, multiples bigger than anyone else even close to that space. Well, there's a couple of would-be competitors out of China and out of South America. Amazon was out overnight again, so Tesla out the night before. Amazon out overnight. As we sat down to record this podcast, the news came out. Now, here's a funny one. Amazon's sales are up 24% year on year, right? That is huge. But then if you actually put that in dollars, not only was it up 24%, because it's already so big, Amazon did $16 billion more sales this year than last year in the most completed quarter. I still can't get my head quite around that scale and the sheer dollar value of the growth. It's Amazon Web Services business, so the kind of cloud computing, I'm going to call it that. We won't get into the details unless you particularly want to. It's cloud computing business, Amazon Web Services, AWS, delivered 9% growth in profits. Shares were down after hours by, when I last saw it, 7%, after being up about 1% during the day. So net 6% change in the last 24 hours. What can the market not like about sales up 24% and profits from AWS up 9%?
Yeah, so I think like the top line numbers are good. Here's, I think this is, as you know, you and I were having this chat, and somewhat jokingly, I said I'm going to sell Amazon at some point.
And we both own Amazon. You own Tesla. I'm just going to quickly get this disclosed out of the way.
And I own Amazon as well. Mm-hmm. Here's my only issue now with Amazon is that if you're a company of $1 trillion market cap, right? Mm-hmm. I expect that you're going to generate a lot of cash, a lot of actual profits that I guess I could buy back shares or give me a dividend or something, right? What I think happened this quarter and what they're actually forecasting for the quarter ahead is it looks like, you know, Amazon is going back into like this investment mode and, you know, basically profits are not increasing at that pace. And, you know, on a year-over-year basis, I thought it's like for next quarter, they're basically projecting a decline. To me, the issue here is simple. The issue here is that in a way, their competitive advantage is basically scale, right? But in a way, online retail is now old hack. Like, I mean, you know, everybody's doing online retail. Like, you know, any company you pick from Premier Investments to Kogan, they're all doing online retail, right?
Yeah.
So in that case, I would assume that you've got plenty scale. Do you really need to spend up that much? I mean, there's no. I don't think there's a way. You know, if this is not a winners take all market anymore in that sense, right? Lots of competitors have come, you know, Walmart is competing and growing its online sales rapidly. So, I'm just worried that the margins are too low, and if you don't generate enough cash over time, then. You know, is the valuation? There's a valuation question that I think is rightly to be asked. Amazon Web Services, I worry less because there are effectively basically two front players, like Amazon and Microsoft, and Google is sort of like, you know, a number two, or you can call it number three, but just it's basically it's like the third leg of the stool,
which is probably still three, you know, worthwhile, large, profitable businesses, but IBM and Amazon clearly the two leaders in the space. Microsoft and Amazon, sorry.
Yeah, they're the two, and then, you know, you have a bunch of others like, you know, IBM and so on and so forth as number three, and that it is a second tier level kind of thing. So I don't know. I think that business is good, but I really worry about this aspect. Like, it is not, at this scale, it's not a cash generative behemoth like, say, Microsoft is or an Apple is, right? And if it's not going to generate cash now, maybe it will never generate cash. Maybe this will be the biggest story stock of all time, that, you know, ultimately retail is retail, right?
Well, this is kind of, I think this is exactly the question that many investors ask when it comes to growth companies, because, you know, we talk about Tesla and Amazon. In one universe, these are reverse companies. In another universe, they both go broke. In another universe, they're the two largest companies in the world, and there's lots in between. To some degree, investors in unprofitable businesses are saying, can I see a future where this company makes enough money to justify the share price? Now, it looks like at this stage, Tesla's kind of passed some sort of inflection point. Amazon arguably not quite there yet. You can see how it might, but also, as you say, there's definite reasons to be cautious and say, well, there's also reasons why it may not. And you've kind of got to believe to some degree that the structural kind of position of the business, the industry it's in and the management team can execute to a scale, size, and market dominance that lets it turn that growth and kind of customer interest and attention and brand value and all that kind of stuff into ongoing profits.
Yeah, that's right. Like, you know, operating income, for example, decreased to $3.2 billion this third quarter. And I think, to me, this is a hard one. And I mean, Amazon has had many periods of reinvestment in the business, right? And see, that's the other thing, right? This is not an asset light business in any shape or form, right? So you need to remember that. Are we thinking of this business as like, you know, a software business that is like very asset light? This is not an asset light business. This is not really Microsoft in any way, right? So are we assigning Microsoft like valuations to something that's somewhere between Microsoft and a Walmart,
yeah.
Right? So those are the things, you know. You know, I genuinely feel at this point that maybe, you know, Amazon is like now the maybe somewhat overrated in that sense. You know, like, you know, for a long time, there was this thing that, you know, the horizon growth is going to happen and, you know, huge, and it has become huge in terms of that, right? But the ability to translate that to actual dollars in profit is the question mark.
I think that's fair. For what it's worth, I remain very confident, not too much confidence, not kind of, you know, sell the house confidence. I said to you this morning, I was partly jesting, partly not. I may well buy some more Amazon shares when trading rules allow. And at the very earliest, now we've produced this podcast, it won't be till Wednesday. We have to wait 2 days after mentioning any company to trade in the shares. So just that's our trading rules. I may well buy some more Amazon. I think the long-term story is still very, very, very attractive. It doesn't take many more years of 24% top-line growth to deliver. I mean, the P/E is now 90, which is pretty high. But it doesn't take too many more years of 25% compound growth to allow a company to make more money and justify that sort of P/E, in my mind. Now, plenty of risks, I'm a fan.
A P/E of 100 for a company of nearly a trillion dollars, no longer a trillion dollar. You know, you're losing the trillion dollar bet handily right now. I just mentioned, people, we have had this bet, and you know.
I don't do that. You're gonna look silly.
But right now I'm winning.
Now, yeah. Sure, but you don't want to declare victory too early, mate. That just hurts more when you lose.
We just closed. The bet is done. Right, it's so over. Destined.
Tell our listeners what the bet is.
Oh, the bet is, and how many years I forgot even now. But in some number of years, which company is going to have more than $1 trillion? Market cap?
I can't remember. Basically, our argument is Amazon versus Apple, and which company's going to be bigger.
Wins. That's like
Amazon's
easy.
Gonna be bigger. You grow at 24%, you're going to. But easy.
You need to generate cash.
Buy Amazon.
Nobody generates cash like Apple.
Buy Amazon. All right. Have we done enough?
Buy Apple.
Let's move on.
Value stocks.
Market.
Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Now, Phil, thank you as always for listening to our podcast. I have some pretty cool feedback, pretty cool mailbag. I'm going to tease it. We're not going to do mailbag just yet, Doc, but I'm just going to tease this one because we got a couple of notes from a couple of listeners who have a couple of sidekicks. So if that sounds like it might be you, keep listening. If it's not, I promise you will love hearing what I have to add when we open up our mailbag in a little bit. So just a bit of a tease. Don't turn off just yet. Make sure you keep listening. I promise it's not clickbait. There is genuine, good quality content coming. You'll be pretty glad you kept listening, I think.
Get more Motley Fool Money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate. Back to Australia. We've done Amazon. We've done Tesla. I'm not sure if this is the third horseman of the apocalypse or the exception that proves the rule, or there's something here, because we're going from two of the most innovative, well-run, market kind of thumping, changing, innovative businesses of our lifetimes. And then we're going to talk about Maya.
That's really a weird combination, you know. Like, here's the thing. If Meyer executives are listening to the show,
yeah,
they should be really glad. Like, we've bunched Meyer with
Tesla. Doing the halo effect.
And just think about the valuation. Think about 100 PE. Well, unless, I mean, does Meyer have a PE?
It's also one of those things, though, right? Like, there's a halo effect sometimes. Or sometimes we're going to compare and contrast. And if you're in that compare and contrast kind of headspace, you really don't want to be, if you're Maya, you don't want to be talked about at the same time as Amazon or Tesla and then compared, right?
I don't know about comparing, but contrasting maybe.
All right. So we had this was a fascinating story during the week, Matt, and we included for some part of kind of, you know, understanding the market, understanding what goes on, and frankly, kind of a little bit of humor. Maya was taken to court by its shareholders. And the shareholders alleged in a class action lawsuit that Meyer misled the market. In other words, Meyer had a profit forecast. It subsequently, a couple of months later, downgraded that profit forecast. And the Meyer shareholders alleged that Meyer should have known and therefore should have communicated more quickly that there was a profit downgrade in the ranks. So effectively, imagine you're running a retail business. You said, look, I think we're going to do X. And then all of a sudden, a couple of weeks later, you go, oh, that's not happening. A couple of weeks later, oh, that's not happening. Things are getting worse. Things are getting worse. As soon as you're reasonably able to tell it to know that it's going to be worse than what you previously guided for, you're obliged under the Australian rules to go and tell the market, hey, we said it was going to be 100, now it's going to be 90, really sorry about that. And the allegation, and frankly the court found in favour of the shareholders, was that they knew the downgrade was coming and didn't tell the market quickly enough. And that's kind of it's a big deal for a whole lot of reasons, right? So this is a relatively landmark case from that perspective. It's the first time, I think, that a class action like this has been won by shareholders in a continuous disclosure world, and basically a reminder to CEOs that you have to tell the market if your forecasts have changed. If you know you're not going to meet previous guidance, you must update the market. The funny thing about it was that the court then said, well, yeah, but there was no damage done because no one believed Meyer anyway. Which I think is kind of, I don't even know what to make of it.
It's a very prescient observation.
Well, that's the thing, right? So basically the court saying, yeah, the market knew you guys weren't really going to do this. So you can't, there was no damage done because no one believed it. If they believed the 100, there would have been problems. But we thought it was going to be 90 anyway. And we thought you were always not exactly not telling the truth. But, you know, you kind of weren't exactly, you know, on the level, and the market kind of saw through that and kind of didn't price in your guidance. So if that was true, there can be no damage done because there's no money lost as a result of that guidance, which is kind of weird, right? So on one level, they're upholding the requirement for continuous disclosure, but also kind of adding some sort of materiality component where they say, but there has to be some evidence of loss. And there simply wasn't in this case because you guys aren't running such a good business that the market expected you could really deliver on what you promised.
I think that's fantastic. I love it. I actually really love it. I mean, here's the thing, right? You believe guidance of some companies. Some companies' guidance, you just look at it and said, right? And actually, you know, this latter half or group of companies, they should actually not be releasing any form of guidance because they're probably terrible at guidance, right?
Can I climb up on the medium-sized horse for a second? I reckon 95% of companies in the ASX shouldn't be providing guidance because at best, you can't know with any certainty 12 months out how a market's going to operate. And at best you deliver guidance. If you're a toll road, okay, you can roughly forecast how many cars are going to use your roads, and frankly, anyone else can as well. If you're a company that relies on the vagaries of the market and competition and economic growth and pricing and exchange rates and everything else, you can't possibly know. And so all it does is it creates these perverse incentives where management put an arbitrary target out there and then twist the business in knots to deliver something they didn't really have any business forecasting in the first place. If it was me, I would literally, I don't know if I'd ban guidance. I got in trouble this week on Twitter for saying I'd ban something else. So maybe banned is too strong a term.
Just don't ban stuff.
I don't need the hate tweets. I would ban it. But anyway. But yes, at some point, right, like you've got to think, I mean, management provide guidance because someone asks and they feel like they should provide it. And that's the way the market kind of works is, you know, what I say, experts don't forecast because they know, but because they're asked. I think it's the same with management guidance, right? I wish they'd all just say, we'll just tell you when we get there.
You know, I'm doing two things. I'm going to go short shorts. You know, like, I mean, I don't short.
But I don't want to see you in short shorts.
No, but I don't want to, I don't short, but I'm short shorts.
Right, which means you're long.
Which means I'm long, but I'm long. I'm short the shorts. You know what I mean?
I do.
And I'm also going to be short guidance, especially in the retail sector. I mean, retail, you do not do guidance.
But you reckon anyone knows? Like, I mean, even the biggest companies in the world, the Googles, the Apples, the Amazons, like, I just don't know why you would bother. You can't physically know what's going to happen. And so all you do is you're lucky, or you say to some poor bastard, hey, you've got to go and do something to get the sales number that I promised 6 months ago because I promised it. Yeah. It literally makes this whole short-termism thing worse.
Yeah. Like, I think some, like, enterprise software companies, for example, they could give very, like, you know, they can give sandbag guidance quite easily.
Oh, you can sandbag anything, yeah.
Yeah, true. Like, I mean, in the sense that, not, you know, you know that, you know, this is the trend and you know that right. how many customers you've got and you know that they're going to be sticking around until, like, next year. You can give guidance. I think, much easier to give guidance for enterprise SaaS companies. Mm. But it's really...
Yeah, like, they're kind of toll roads in that kind of
it's,
way.
It's kind of like a toll road, yeah. right? So it's a toll road company, enterprise SaaS companies, even companies like, you know, that take a cut off, like, you know, payments companies that take a cut and things like that.
Right.
Those guys, I think, are even the payments companies, right? They're actually, you know, subject to economic uncertainties, right? So people spend less, they have less money going through. But yeah, like, you know...
There's no value in it. Like, even if you could... forecast, why would you bother? Like, what's the upside?
No, there's a lot of value, right? You're construing value to be a very small term here. So you think about the value. A company gives gives guidance, shareholders don't like it, then they can go to the court. So many people, there's so many jobs being created out here. Like,
dude, be careful here, because what our listeners are hearing is Doc saying, I really think there should be more lawyers. We should pay more money to lawyers.
No. All I'm saying is, this is all helping our unemployment numbers.
Keeping lawyers in a job.
Well, you know, like, just, you know, courts just don't run on lawyers, right? There are people who are, you know, in the court. There are people who are going to be taking notes in the court. There's like the, you know, there's the cleaning company that's going to clean the court. I mean, this is a huge deal.
We have a legal system-led recovery.
This is, like, awesome. Like, I mean, this is how you create jobs, right? You know, I'm totally fine with this. And I think, you know, the court in this case is taking a very nuanced view, which I love. Like, you know, so this is awesome. I'm totally in support of this.
I'm glad you're in a good mood, because I've got some wonderful news that will make you even happier about your favorite topic.
Oh, let's do that.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Break out the champagne. The popping noise you can hear in the background. Pop. See, that was in the back. We don't have a lot of sound effects here. That was the champagne corks popping, mate. Property is back. Capital City property prices up the most in the last 2 years, in the most recent quarter. Everything's over. Cancel the recession. Cancel the property bust. We are off to the races. Property's okay. We can all pile back in. Welcome back, Dr. Team Optimism. This is great.
Oh, I love the word you used. Let's pile back in. This is like, you know, so property is our version of the, what I call the Momo stocks. You know what, you know, momentum driven stocks. Like, property is like complete momentum. Like, okay, everybody's buying. Okay, I'm missing out. Let me buy too. Oh, everybody's buying. I'm missing out too. I should buy too. Right.
Okay, when you got on the property's down bandwagon, you got to
say, I'm still holding on to that. I still believe in due course the property has to correct. There's just no way this is going to continue.
Okay, but you're not silly enough to actually do what most forecasts do and actually put a time frame on that, are you?
No. I never, for most forecasts, I don't put a time frame.
I've told you before, mate, I have three forecasts every year for the market. Mm. The market will either be up, down, or go nowhere. And I'll be right by the end of the year.
No, I have a simple forecast for property. It is going to be down 30% from the peak sometime.
2000
Well, you know, like, you know, like in stocks, we say that was a dead cat bounce.
Yes.
So in property...
Even dead cats bounce if they fall hard enough.
Exactly.
It's a long phrase, yes.
It's a long phrase. So I think this is one of those...
It's a gruesome one, but yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, this is that version of the... Okay, the dead cat is bouncing.
So this is the short-term rally before the correction.
I don't put time frames, but it is definitely...
So how do we know if you're ever going to be wrong then? Let's put you on the spot for a second.
Yeah.
Eventually is a very, very long time.
Yeah.
Could be when we're both dead. Is that how far out you're going?
No, in my lifetime, for sure. I'm definitely
like
sure.
You're a young man. That could be 55 years.
I don't know. I don't know.
There'll be a property crash by 2020, was it 2071?
Something. Something. But whatever. Like, I mean, this is an untenable situation where the property goes up. Now the amount of deposit required to buy stuff goes up. People don't
there's
a lot of problems. There's a lot of problems that high property prices bring. I mean, high property prices actually do nobody a favor other than to continue, I guess, building a debt burden, which ultimately somebody has to bear, right? I think that's what high... I mean, there's no advantage to high property price.
Mate, in fact, you are the Grinch that stole the property Christmas.
I'm basically saying that in a civil society, property is basically a place where people live. Mm. And if that is affordable, you have more money for doing everything else. Yep. That is...
As a policy question, that's, I mean, the financialization of property is really the big policy question for government.
It's like, I mean, the holy grail is that you have less money now in your pocket because everything is going into that black box.
Right.
And that to me is basically taking away from all sorts of, you know, whether it's consumer driven, enjoyment to, you know,
consumer spending investments
right, and everything right. else. Right. So it's basically a black hole. It's
and
a
you tell me
hole.
You're not the Grinch. Come on, you don't call property a black hole. You're the Grinch.
It's definitely a black hole. I mean, there is no reason to believe that property as an asset class should be an asset class which should... It's not even a productive asset class.
Maybe
it
we
does
have
not
a property
produce,
expert on here to different balance.
Well, I am the property expert. It is not a productive asset class. It produces nothing of value, right? It should not. It's a place. I mean, it's basically a depreciating asset class, right? Everything in that, you know, your wood should, over time, the termite should be eating up the wood.
We're in a very dark place right now, man. I'm feeling very depressed. I'm down.
I'm painting the beautiful Australia where everyone can afford a house. Everyone. So everybody's got a roof. Like, think about how
all the rest of us have to do is like a 50% haircut on our property prices.
Well, I mean, who told you to pay too much? I mean, that's your problem. But you think about it this way, like everybody has a house, then everybody has lots of money in their pocket to do whatever they feel like, you know, go on holidays.
Buy a house,
you know, not buy a house, don't buy a house. You've got one house. All you need is one house. You don't need 15 houses. I mean, what do you do? The house doesn't lay eggs, right? So, you know.
If you're doing well, yes, that's right.
So what you want to do is.
If it does, get off the gear.
You want one house.
Mm-hmm.
You want it to be cheap, very cheap, so that you have money in your pocket for doing other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That is the holy grail. I am recommending that the government looks at this as a policy question.
Do you have officially stolen the high horse and ridden it way off into the sunset? Well done.
I this was not a horse. If I was riding a horse, this would be a long one.
a long ride.
I'm going to stop.
The 1,000 meter at Randwick. It's almost summertime, past the spring carnival, but you've done a lovely 1,000 meter dash on the high horse, mate. Well done.
Okay.
I want to get onto some of my favorite ever correspondence we've received here at Motley Fool Money. Stay tuned.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Time to dip into the Fool mailbag, mate, in a really, really, really cool way. I teased this a bit earlier and I'm just, you know, like we're not brain surgeons, right? Your good wife is in the medical profession. My good wife is in the teaching profession.
I am not a surgeon.
You and I just kind of make money for people, right? Like that's, you know, it's not a bad living and it's not a bad thing to do. And we're hopefully helping our listeners become better educated and take care of their financial futures. That's got some value. But we're not saving lives, are we?
No. I mean, I'm making up stuff on this podcast right now. So
after that property thing,
please,
mate.
Please take everything with a lot of salt. Not even a grain of salt, a lot of salt.
But we do what we can and we try and add value. And look, this podcast is all about, for, you know, if you're paying for this podcast, you're getting ripped off because everyone else is getting it free. This is a free podcast to hopefully help our listeners just get a bit more financially savvy, take a bit more control of their finances, live better lives. And frankly, we hope that for everybody in Australia, right? So this is why we do it. And outside Australia, we've got some listeners from around the world, which is kind of cool.
I have a suggestion for, you know, every listener. You know, maybe this would be really cool.
You're getting
cool.
back on the high horse here.
No. Okay. This is a very cool suggestion, you know, because you said it's a free podcast,
yes,
right?
Yes, it is.
So every time in Australia, somebody utters the word property, just, you know, which is like in a lot of barbecues and parties and, you know, things like that.
What do we have
to
do?
Just casual. Just give us 1 cent. Just 1 cent to the Motley Fool Triple M Money podcast.
Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast. We'll send you our bank details. Send us a cent every time you hear the word property.
Just 1 cent.
Won't cost you much, will it?
Maybe. I think we'll make a fortune.
We may bankrupt our listeners. Mate, but look, let me get back to my point, because we thrive on the feedback of our listeners. This is, you know, our mailbag is our favourite segment, as we've said before. We got some really, really, really cool, two in particular bits of mail this week. And the first one came from, if you send me some mail this week, particularly if you're not as old as Doc and I, stay tuned, because this might be you. Here came the first one, mate. It says, "Hi, Scott and Doc. Just wanted to say thanks for all the money hacks. I've saved a packet by calling the bank and getting a better rate, and I've started putting that into shares through CommSec Pocket. Another handy tip." How cool is that? So we've saved some money on the mortgage, helped them invest, loving it, right? Gets better. "I love listening to the podcast. It's fantastic for a beginner like me to learn about investing." So cool. Here's the very, very favourite part of this. This made my week last week. He then says, and my son, aged 10, listens to and is getting a great financial education. Love your work, guys. Thank you so much. From Jeff and 10-year-old Fletcher. How cool is that?
That is awesome.
Isn't that cool?
That is brilliant.
So Fletcher, g'day, mate. Thank you so much for listening. We love that everyone listens to this podcast. If we are helping you get a little bit of financial education, helping you kind of sort the good stuff from the bad stuff, setting you up for hopefully a very sustainable and successful life in investing, then we are stoked. And Fletcher, you have the best, the very, very best thing. I can't have it. Doc can't have it. No one else can have it. You're 10. You have got literally 7, 8, 9 decades ahead of you to invest. And if you keep up your listening, keep up your saving, start investing, you will just be miles and miles and miles ahead of your friends. So, mate, good on you. Well done for listening. Thank you for listening. And thanks, Jeff, for letting us know that you and Fletcher listen, because we're just super, super excited about it.
That is awesome. Yeah, I have nothing to add to that. I mean, you know, Fletcher, you're just going to be so much ahead. I'm going to be a bit jealous about that.
Oh, mate, 10. Yeah. Can you imagine being 10 again?
I would like to be 10.
Oh, yeah.
But you know,
I would love to be 10.
Kudos to, you know, Fletcher. And, you know, like, I mean, this is brilliant. I mean, this is such a good thing to do.
Yeah, it's awesome. Now, that made my week last week. I got that last Saturday morning, I think I want to say. Maybe it was Friday afternoon. And then so then this week, it gets better, right? So not only were Jeff and Fletcher listening last week and flicked us a note, and again, thank you, Jeff, for doing that. We got another Twitter message this week. That was on Instagram, by the way. We're on the socials. I'll give you those details in a minute. We got another one this week. It's from Hales on Twitter. And Hales says, hey, Scott and Doc, just listening to your Money Hacks podcast this evening with the fam. My son was wondering about what advice you have for 8-year-olds who are looking to add to their portfolios. He says he used his own money to buy BHP in January this year. What to buy next? Now, Hales, I follow up with Hales, and Hales' son's name is Miles. So, Miles, good day to you. Maybe you and Fletcher should start an investment club, I think, from the sound of it. I'll put us out of a job, mate. Maybe they shouldn't do that. Don't do that. Don't.
It sounds very risky. It sounds very, very risky.
But don't do that, please. Go to other things with your lives. We need this job. But Miles, thank you, mate, for also listening. He also sent a wonderful photo of Miles holding up his BHP share statement, which is just really, really cool. Well done, Miles. Really, really impressed, dude. Good job for listening. He also says that, so Hales tells me that his favorite, well, this is a little uncomfortable because Hales says, he says he'll be so pumped. He listens to every podcast, which is lovely. His name is Miles. Well, he knows what delayed gratification is. It seems his favorite line is, and it's one of our promo lines, mate, that the good people here at Triple M have added to our podcast. And Miles and Fletcher, block your ears for a second. His favourite line is, not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche.
I love that.
And so I felt a bit guilty about that. So from now on, I'm Richard Phillips and you're Richard Mahanty.
Mm-hmm.
Dick. I feel obligated to change my name. I'm sorry, Miles. You know, adult stuff, adults say that stuff. Don't say it at school. You'll get yourself in trouble and, you know, that'll be in trouble and I'll be in trouble and no one wants that. So I'm now officially Richard Phillips and he's Richard Mahanty. It's not like the two Ronnies. That's a whole different story. Miles, the two Ronnies is way, way, way too old for you. Mate, they were old when I was a kid. The two Ronnies are well and truly past their prime. But yeah, we're both Richards, which is good, I think. Miles, really cool, but well done for buying BHP. He bought it with his own money. He's saving up more money to buy his next stock. How cool is that?
That is brilliant. That is just so awesome. Like, I mean, yeah, talk about
isn't that cool?
Talk about starting early and getting ahead. Like, oh, I mean, this is just amazing.
So cool. Anyway, so then just to flesh that a bit, I then hit Hales up as a direct message. So he said, I only started buying a few stocks last December at 40. This is Hales, not Miles, obviously. He started listening and just took a liking to it. So I figure we get some credit for that.
We should.
Miles, I was really impressed, dude, but what are you doing listening to us? Isn't there something else you can listen to?
Oh,
Is it Pharrell Williams or Taylor Swift? What are kids listening to these days?
We're the best. That's what I know.
I don't even know what kids listen to these days.
I have no idea.
No. But mate, good on you for listening. He says that he saved his birthday, Christmas and pocket money to buy $500 worth of BHP, plus commission, of course. He has a watch list and always wants to know how he can earn another $500 so he can diversify. He opens the weekend paper to see what recommendations are in it, and when I check out your site each morning, he's always looking over my shoulder. He even checked out the Pocket app, but we discussed the fees. I'm so proud, because I'm far from money smart. My 10-year daughter is late to the party. She spends her money, but she has elected VAS as her first buy, which is the Vanguard Australian Shares ETF, and she should have enough by Christmas. Thanks for your content. Safe to say it might have a massive impact on my kids' futures. Mate, it's not about us, but I couldn't be more, I honestly couldn't be more stoked. If we are helping kids and older people, frankly, get started investing, like that's why we're here, right? That's exactly what we're here for. So thank you for listening. All of you who are listening, even those who aren't necessarily contacting us, feel free to, by the way. But Miles and Fletcher, guys, thank you very, very much for listening. And more importantly, good on you for jumping in and getting involved in investing. You'll be just really, 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 you'll benefit massively from it. So well done, really impressed, and congratulations. Now, mate, I can't leave it at that, though, because Miles had a question.
What is the question?
Well, to repeat Hales' question, he says he used his own money to buy BHP in January this year, but Miles wants to know what to buy next. Now, we can't give personal advice to Miles just to keep the regulators happy, but we can talk about stocks that might be suitable for someone like Miles. If he's going to buy something in the ASX with another $500, what should he buy next, mate?
Lots of possibilities.
Yes, there are.
Again, if you keep adding, then, and if you take your, depends on, again, it becomes hard because, first stock is BHP. I would never actually tell anyone to buy BHP as the first stock, but I get it.
You have Miles, and that's great.
But you've bought BHP, which is it's better than not buying anything. And BHP pays is a nice, handy dividend.
Blue chip, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, maybe for a child, it's sort of a blue chip focus and buying things that, I guess they can see around or hear around is actually a good thing.
Yeah.
So, something like the Macquarie Group, for example, is really good, a good company to buy. It pays a nice little dividend. Not little, but pays a nice enough. It's a globally recognized,
yep,
Australian brand. You'd hear it on TV. You'd read about it in the paper. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a good one. I mean, you could buy maybe ETFs. That's this other options.
Miles' sister is looking at that apparently.
Yep. Yeah. So I mean, you can buy the NASDAQ 100 ETF, for example. That's a nice one to buy. Gives you exposure to all the companies we sort of talked about before.
Hit some of those, Matt. So for Miles, who's looking at the market now and he's thinking about some of the companies he's buying, a NASDAQ ETF. NASDAQ is the US tech index for shorthand. What sort of companies would Miles be getting part of if he was to buy a NASDAQ ETF?
Yeah, like if he's buying NASDAQ ETFs, he's getting a piece of Apple, piece of, things like Google or Alphabet as it's now known, Microsoft, Amazon.
Netflix, Facebook,
even a bit of Tesla, you get that type of exposure.
Kind of cool.
In a basket sort of format, which is really cool.
I should disclose I own some shares of that.
I think that's a cool option actually as a long-term sort of compounding option. You don't get much dividend, but I think it'll compound nicely over the long term and have the benefit of being an ETF. What else? I mean, I'm not suggesting any from my service extreme opportunities, largely because I think the volatility might not be too suitable at for someone who's just starting to it's better to actually have better to buy things that you can sort of think about and feel about and understand and not buy things that are might be racy but have big futures but also can blow up, right? So I think those would be good ones to buy. I think those would be, in my opinion, good ones. Something like what else? I mean, yeah, I was going to say maybe treasury too, but I mean I'd say wine cellar. I don't know how I'd feel about telling 8 and 10 year olds to buy something that sells wines, but maybe that's fine too. So those are sort of some of the ideas I can think of off the top of my head. ETFs, I think, are a good option.
Nice. I'll take some of what you're talking about there. I'm going to extend it a bit further, Miles. I reckon, dude, it kind of depends on what you want to buy, right? Like, I think, as long as you know that these are volatile, BHP, your $500 worth of BHP could be worth $400 or $600 by the end of the year. And you need to know that's going to happen, right? Volatility is exactly what happens. That's just price movements up and down. So share prices move for whole lots of reasons. Often they're unrelated to the actual businesses themselves. So if the market starts to dislike BHP just because it does, the shares will fall. And you might feel kind of a bit, unhappy about that because all of a sudden you've lost this money and that can feel really, really bad. You can also make $100 or so and you think, well, gee, I've done well. I'm really happy with that. That can happen for reasons that aren't anything to do with the quality of the company or the way you pick the stocks, just because the market is the market is the market. So that's Doc's point about being volatile and just feeling, you know, trying to think through how you're going to feel about things like that moving. I'm a fan, mate. If you want to, I'm a big fan of kind of getting used to owning shares by owning shares in businesses that you use yourself. I know from personal experience, I've had family members who, having bought shares in Myer or DJ's or Woolworths or something else, kind of walk into those shops and kind of go, yeah, I own some of this. And it really changes the way you think about business and investing. And I think that in itself, particularly while you're getting started, is a really, really valuable experience to have. So I would actually say, I don't think these are necessarily the very best businesses or best investment opportunities in the world in pure terms. But I reckon if you're getting started, not because you're a kid, you're more than capable, and you're very mature, obviously. So you're capable of thinking these things through. But there's just something really, really powerful about, you know what? If mum and dad have a Telstra account, buy some Telstra shares. And then you know, every time they use the phone, you're making a little bit of money. Or if you're shopping Woolies or Coles, maybe buy some Woolies or Coles shares. Because hey, every time you go to Woolies, you can say, well, I own part of this. And when you shop there, you feel good about some of that money trickling back in a very, very small way, back to your share price. If you, given your age, mate, you might well be familiar with Smiggle, the stationery business. Premier Investments is the name of the company that owns that business. And again, same thing, if you or your mates or your friends or your sister are shopping in Smiggle, well, you make a little bit of money every time that happens. And that's kind of a really, really useful way to get used to, because share ownership really isn't about the prices in the paper, though that's cool. That's not really about the stats or the codes or the charts or whatever. It's really about owning little pieces of businesses. And you know that obviously by now, because you've been listening to us for a while. But if you can take that and use that for good, if you can start to, you know, really internalize that and get used to that idea, then you're going to be better off than, frankly, most of the people in the market. So here's a little secret that you've got that most people don't. When they go, you know, professional investors and traders and all that kind of stuff, they're all jumping all over the idea of, investing in stocks that might wiggle around and move around. They look at charts and they look at stats and they kind of try and be clever about these things. You and I know something that most people don't remember, which is, and Doc knows this, of course, as well, but which is these are parts of businesses. And if Woolworths sells more groceries, if Coles sells more groceries, if Telstra sells more phones or has more phone accounts, if Smiggle sells more stationery, then the company makes more money, at least in theory, and the shareholders get richer. So that is the core of owning shares, and that's exactly what I reckon you should do. So, yep, by all means, grab some Treasury, to Doc's point, grab some NASDAQ. Same thing, right? If you use Facebook, or you probably don't, hopefully, but maybe your mum and dad do. If you maybe see Netflix, maybe mum and dad got a Netflix account. Maybe you see a Tesla driving past.
Maybe you've got an iPad.
Maybe you've got an iPad. Maybe you're buying stuff from Amazon. All that stuff, right? If you use the iPad, you maybe buy some Apple Music, or you buy something on Amazon, or you watch a Netflix show. Again, part of that money goes back to you. And there's nothing more powerful than realizing you own a piece of that business. So that's what I would go with. Find something you like as a consumer, or your family uses as consumers, and maybe put your money into that. Again, build that over time so you'll add some more to something else next time. But I would start with that sort of stuff and get used to being owner of a business. Talk any more than that?
No, I think you've covered everything.
Mate, I've got two announcements, or a second announcement anyway. The good news is we are going close to time.
Ha, huh, that's always the good news.
Well,
is that
for our listeners, if they want to get rid of us.
Tell me the flip side.
Well, the flip side is the good news, mate.
Okay, what's the good news?
I'm officially declaring a bonus mailbag episode this Sunday, because we've got a lot of mail, a lot of people who asked us questions, and we want to get to it. We're not going to get to it in this particular episode. Well, we might have a bonus episode. What do you reckon? You going to hang around?
Yeah.
Beautiful. There you go. So if you like our bonus mailbag episodes, hopefully you do. The feedback's been really good, by the way, and I'm not just saying that. No one said don't do them, so we figure that's a good thing. By the way, they might start now because they've said, well, hang on. Maybe they think if they tell us they don't want it, we won't do it. But lots of people said, look, we love the extra episodes. We love the mailbag. Thanks for doing it. So I'm going to assume that's legitimate. I'm going to assume that's fair. And we're going to do a mailbag because we've got so much mail here in front of me, mate. There's lots and lots and lots of stuff going on. Before we do, I've got one more question, though. Let's finish that one off, and then we'll call it a day and reconvene for the mailbag. So here's the last question I've got for you from the mailbag, from Chris on Facebook. I'll go through the socials in a second, so grab a pen, but I'll ask Chris's question first. He says, some companies offer dividend reinvestment plans in the form of stock, not cash. In these rare cases, dividends are fully able to compound over time without the tax man's influence. Would it stand to reason that for long-term investors, this would be a better strategy than investing in cash dividend stocks? Similarly, in the long term, would stocks paying zero dividend also have the same compounding effect of zero taxation? So a really cool question. Two separate questions, then we'll ask them separately. So firstly, mate, some companies, so, you know, if you invest, I don't know, particularly I'll use Woolies because I know they have one or we had one. Rather than getting my, you know, $50 Woolies dividend check, I don't own shares for the record, but if I did, they would say, well, rather than your $50 dividend check, here's two shares. And they give you, you know, you basically get more shares rather than cash in the bank. And Chris is saying, wouldn't that be better because there's no tax than if I got cash dividends, had to pay tax on that?
So I'm not sure. Okay, so I might be a little caught off guard here. Isn't it the case that basically this is the basically dividend reinvestment plan, right? So, you know, effectively there is tax as far as I understand, because effectively what the company is saying, well, you know, I was going to pay you like $1. Mm-hmm. So paying you $1, I'm going to give you some shares. Well, I mean, it's your choice. You're making the choice in that case that, you know, it's not like a stock split or something, right? It's correct. Not that they split the stocks and they gave you more stocks, which is effectively basically your ownership did not change mm-hmm. in any form. Here you decided, elected to take that cash and instead basically what, this is from a company point of view better in the sense that, well, it's better than what, it has both sides. It's better because they have to shell out less cash mm-hmm. because they're basically printing the shares, which means, right. So they're printing the shares. This is like quantitative easing. The finance market, all the Fed chairs understood or learned quantitative easing from the finance market, you know, from the stock market, basically, right. Because they print shares all right. the time. So, yeah, so Woolies basically decided that instead of giving out cash, which, you know, maybe I don't have enough of, mm-hmm. I can just, you know, print some shares right. and then pretend that, you know, that's your dividend, right? Well, you know, the tax man is going to say, No. You still pay me tax on that. But yeah, it does help with compounding because, you know, if you got the cash and you didn't buy shares, I mean, mm-hmm. then that's just cash, right?
So let's just stop for half a second. I just want to double underline that point before we move on to the compounding bit. So Chris, to be really, really clear and for everyone who's listening, if you get shares rather than cash, you are still up for exactly the same tax bill as if you'd received the cash, right? The tax man effectively says you got X dollars worth of shares. He treats it as if you'd got the cash then bought the shares. And so you still have exactly the same tax bill, regardless whether you get the dividend in cash or shares.
Right.
Yeah. Go to the compounding bit, mate.
Yeah. And then I think then, you know, you, from a tax man point of view, you got cash. That cash was basically used to buy shares. Mm-hmm. Now, the advantage here is that, you know, you didn't take the cash and, you know, buy coffee out of it. Instead, you just, you didn't consume it.
So
instead,
that's a win.
You know, so that's the first win. So you basically became a saving. That saving basically became the share. And then over the long haul, hopefully mm-hmm. the share basically compounds like your other holdings. So that's where the compounding bit is coming from.
Right.
Basically, by turning it into shares, you're basically allowing it to run. And then on that basis, you basically are getting, you know, you're getting your compound gain, and you're going to have, you know, if you have capital gains tax benefits and things like that, that's what you're going to get that bit from.
Yeah.
So, it's a nice nifty thing to do. It's also a nice nifty thing to do if you believe in doing, like, you know, dollar cost averaging, right? So you want to do dollar cost averaging, then this is a nice nifty way of all the dividend comes in, you get more shares, you like the company anyways. I mean, technically, if you did not like the company, you would not own the shares, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you own the shares, you could own some more. And if you're doing that for a lot of companies, then effectively, you know, you're just basically, you're just putting your cash that comes in into your, you know, brokerage from your in your brokerage account into shares, basically right. automatically buying shares. It's a nice, as a toolkit, I think it's nice and nifty. Mm-hmm. I will just say, again, everybody has to decide what's good for them. I actually don't do it.
Yeah.
Largely because I feel that, you know, I get the cash and I decide what I want to do with. I mean, any cash that comes to my brokerage account, I actually don't take it out. I invest it, mm-hmm. but I invest in a different company. Almost always.
So you get your Apple dividend, for example, but you think Tesla's a better buy, again, for argument's sake, rather than being forced to arbitrarily buy shares in Apple again or Amazon again or whatever, and it doesn't matter what company it was.
Yeah, yeah.
You kind of go, I'll take that money and I'll say, well, I got my $1,000 worth of dividends over the last 12 months on all of my companies, but the $1,000 is best going into Tesla, just again for the argument today. And so rather than having little bits of extra Apple, a little bit of extra Amazon, a little bit of extra whatever else you own, you're saying, no, I want to take this all this cash in total and invest it in my best idea or ideas.
Yeah, sometimes it's investing, you know, it's a question of even if my like best idea happened to be, let's say, Amazon, and I owned Amazon shares, it could just be sometimes that I don't want that position. So it may be a big position. I didn't want to increase that position. So I like to have that control. Mm. But you know, some people, I think, who don't have lopsided portfolios in one particular position or other, which is too big. You know, for that, like, I know lots of people who actually love, and this is really a popular technique, dividend reinvestment plans or DRIP. I think it's good. Again, everybody needs to decide what. I don't do it, but I think I know a lot of people who do it.
Yeah, so. I think Your point about a tool in a toolkit, I think, is a really great way to describe it, Doc, because, you know, dividend reinvestment, it depends on what you want to do and how you manage your own finances, right? If you're someone who can't see the money in the account without spending it or without doing something else with it, go and put the money into a DRP. You know, literally, you know, take it's a kind of a behavioral nudge, right? The idea is if the company's going to do it for you, it saves you doing something else bad with the money. If you're that sort of person, or frankly, even if you're someone who kind of doesn't even get around to it, or you don't have a separate investment savings account, right? They're the reasons why you'd want to go and do it. Or if you just don't want to have the decision made, you don't have to make the decision, you're happy to just let it do its thing. As Doc says, just go and do it. On the flip side, I actually agree with Doc. Firstly, please, everybody, have a separate investment account that your investing cash goes into and your dividends get paid into. Don't ever have your dividends paid in your savings account or your transaction account, because you will use the money, I guarantee it. Again, you probably think you're the different person, but 90% of us think we're above average drivers too, right? So there's every chance that you will fall foul of the same problems that I have, that Doc has, that everyone else has, which is when the money's there, you can mentally say, oh, no, I've got to leave that $100 aside because that was dividend cash. And then you've got a bill to pay or something else happens, or you just simply have a big night on the tiles and you know, buy a couple more rounds than you should have. All of a sudden that money disappears and you go, oh, next time I'll do it. So use DRP if you want it taken out of your own hands, but please, everybody, find a separate investment account. Frankly, I'm with CommSec. We have no relationship with CommSec. I find them just a really easy combination because they have a direct investment account linked to it when you open an account. That way, all my investing money goes from my paycheck. Some proportion of that goes into the investment account. My share purchases happen there. My dividends go back into there. And it just sequesters the entire cash, so I'm never tempted to use it. So DRPs are great, but if you don't use DRPs, please, for the love of God, have a separate investing account. Any more to add?
I have nothing to add.
Mate, Chris has a second part of his question. So he says, similarly, in the long term, would stocks paying a zero dividend also have the same compounding effect of zero taxation? Now, we've unfortunately, Chris, sorry, mate, put paid to the zero taxation question, at least for your DRP question. But, Doc, to some degree, a company that doesn't pay dividends. Now, on one hand, the investor doesn't have to pay tax on those dividends. So in this case, there isn't a dividend to be paid. So corporate tax is still paid either way. But I'm not paying tax on the dividend, so effectively I'm leaving that money with the company to compound for me. Now, the best case of this I have in my favourite company that I'm contractually obliged to mention at least once a podcast, Berkshire Hathaway. Buffett hasn't paid a dividend since 1965 for exactly this reason. Buffett says, look, I could pay you a dividend and you'd have to pay tax on that and then reinvest it somewhere else. And so if I pay you $100 of dividends, you're going to have 85 odd left or 80 left to reinvest somewhere else. How about you leave the $100 with me? I've still paid my corporate tax. But I'm then going to invest that on your behalf, and I think I can compound that better for you without you having to pay extra dividend tax. I'll give you know, effectively you'll let that capital gain ride, let that growth happen, and then take out the money down the track when it's compounded for many, many years. So I think in this case, Chris's question is really quite valid, or at least a really good question to ask, which is, shouldn't companies keep the money and use it to grow the company's value, effectively tax-free in the hands of the shareholder? They still pay corporate tax, as we say. Isn't that better than having dividends paid out and having to pay, and depending on your franking level and your own tax rate, somewhere between nothing and 15 or 18% tax on that money?
Yeah, I think that's great. So you used your favorite company. I'll use my favorite company. And I will
that's
say...
That's what we do.
That's what we do here. We just talk about our own favorite companies. Let's say you bought Apple shares on 2000. Let's make it 2008.
Oh, here somewhere. We go. Selective data here.
Yeah, I'm just going to use. I'm using 2008 because I'm using 2008 largely because that's what, 2007 the yep. iPhone came, right?
Yep.
So let's make this even. I'm looking at some random date because that's what I could quickly find on Bing. I use Bing. I'll just make that clear. I don't use Google. I love my privacy. So, anyways, I made 2 points here now. So on that particular date, let's say in end of February, Apple shares were at $18.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's not paying a dividend at that time, I think. Right, and here's the magic, right? The magic is that if you let a company do its thing, invest for growth, it grows. At some point, it becomes like an Apple. Well, not every company is going to become very few companies are going to be like Apple. But even if it's a pale version of Apple,
yep.
A mature company at some stage is going to be able to generate a lot of cash,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So when it's generating a lot of cash at that point, even then, it could do various things. It could buy back its shares and, so therefore, basically, you're not paying any taxes unless you're actually selling out.
Mm.
But you fast forward to today and the shares are like $240, right? Mm. And if you're getting a 1.7% or 1.5% yield on that $240. Mm-hmm. Well, that's actually a huge yield on your initial capital investment mm-hmm. if you invested in like 2008, right? Mm-hmm. So in 12 years, your yield on your capital investments actually could be very high for a company that's actually delivering growth, has gone through the growth phase, then mm-hmm. has become basically a mature blue chip behemoth, right? If I have to use an Australian example, I could say something like the same story for, you know, people who bought shares when Commonwealth Bank floated, mm-hmm. for example, right?
Yep.
I mean, if it floated for like $2 or something like that, if I remember correctly. You know, on that cash, you're getting huge amount of yields. I mean, and today's yield is great, right? I mean, it's like 6% or something like that. You know, that's a pretty hefty yield. But so I like to invest. Like, if you don't need the income right now, I like to invest for growth, with the expectation that my growth company at some point in the future becomes a dividend paying blue chip, solid blue chip, you know, blue chip aristocrat or blue chip, you know, growth, whatever you want to call it. And I'm going to be happy actually with that yield that I get, even if it's like a 2% yield, that'll be probably enough because I've got a lot of capital appreciation that's happened. So I can feel happy about the capital
and
a bit of both. It's like, you know, it's a nice, you know,
Mate, I think that's exactly right. I'm going to just for the sake of kind of sharing the devil's advocate position, or at least both sides of the same coin, so we can educate our listeners. Generally speaking, like in most investing, quality of the company you buy and the management team you back is really paramount, right? So there's a lot of people in the Australian market in particular. We're a hyper-dividend market, right? Our yield here, the average is about 4.5%. In the US, I want to say like 2.1, Doc. Is that kind of close to right?
Yeah, it's probably like 2% in the US.
So, you know, we're a hyper-dividend market. Now, those who like dividends, or frankly, who are a bit cynical, say, well, actually, if you give me the dividends, you can't go and waste the money. And there's frankly been a lot of examples of companies who have gone and wasted cash, right? If the company hoards the cash, instead of paying you the $10 million, you're part of that $10 million in dividends, for example, in one given year, they might say, I've got $10 million in the back pocket. It's kind of burning a hole in the pocket. I could go and buy this thing or start this operation or spend this money on marketing or make this acquisition. And those can be great. If you've got a great management team with super good capital allocation skills and really good business smarts, that's great. There is, as I said, the cynical group who would say, you know what, I've been around the market a little bit now. I don't trust you guys to exactly do the right thing. Now, Buffett, master capital allocator. Tim Cook has done a great job after Steve Jobs of creating value from Apple by reinvesting the cash that was available and still remains available to that company. So those companies and others are absolute standouts where you actually would say, you know what, if you, Mr. Buffett, Mr. Cook, Mr. whoever, think you can use this money, Bezos at Amazon, think you can use this money really, really well, and I'm going to trust you to deliver a good return on that capital, then absolutely you're dead right. It's the great thing to do. On the other hand, if you're like, hey, and BHP was targeted on this one, by the way, by Elliott Capital Management. I want to say last year, maybe the year before, where they basically came out and said, we don't trust you, BHP. We want you to buy back some shares. We want you to pay a special dividend. We want you to give us all this cash before you guys go and waste it. Now, I don't know if they said exactly that, and I probably should say allegedly in a couple of times there because, you know, I don't want to put words in their mouth or impugn the wonderful people at BHP. But at some level, they had a view to say that, you know, they didn't want BHP making more acquisitions. They wanted the money back from the business. And they would say, look, you know, we don't want you making deals. We want you to give us the cash that the business is throwing off. And they're both sides of that same coin. So answer your question, in a good business, Chris, if you've got a great company and they're going to use the capital well, you're absolutely right. You want them to keep it and go and compound that growth, a la Apple, a la Berkshire. If they are maybe not so high quality, or simply you're not sure, or the money's lazily sitting on the balance sheet, and frankly, both Berkshire and Apple can be accused meaningfully of having too much cash on the balance sheet and wasting that opportunity to either buy shares back or pay a dividend. If they can't use the money well, then you want that back in your pocket so you can go and find the next best investment to make. Any more, Doc?
No, sir.
We have a mailbag episode coming up, so stay tuned for more of Mailbag Goodness on Sunday, hopefully, if the good boffins at Triple M schedule the podcast the way I hope they will. In any case, I'm sure you'll see it. In the meantime, you can hit us up on the socials. Let's run through them. If you're on Facebook, hit us up, The Motley Fool Australia. Surprise, surprise, not very surprising. Or my page at Scott Phillips Money. There's another Scott Phillips on there, by the way, who's a share trader out of the US. And that's not my Scott Phillips. Scott Phillips Money is my Twitter handle, my Facebook handle, sorry. Hit me up there. Like my page, follow, send us a message on the Motley Fool account as well. If you're on the Twitters, hit us up at Anirban Mahanti is Doc. I'm at TMF Scott P. Or The Motley Fool is at The Motley Fool AU. And those last two are our Insta handles as well. Can you say Insta handles? Yeah, I've asked them one person,
don't
I?
Yeah, I don't know. I was going to do a complete, you know, like a tangent here.
Let me finish, and then we'll go to your tangent.
Wait.
All right.
That other Scott.
Yes. Oh, we know. Let's not impugn anybody.
No. I'm just saying, can it be you, Dr. Jekyll, Hyde kind of thing going on here?
Indulging in my day trading passion.
Yeah, like, you know, maybe at night you're like day trading and a day, like, I mean, your night, you're day trading in the US maybe.
Thankfully for all of us, mate, there's a picture of him and he's not me and I'm not him. There are some famous Scott Phillipses out there. One's a drummer with a rock band.
Okay, that's better.
Another is... He produces adult movies in Brisbane, apparently. So that's not me either. Scott, use the Twitter handle.
You're very quickly saying that's not you.
Search Scott Phillips Money on Facebook or on the Instas, The Motley Fool AU or TMF Scott P, the same as our Twitter handles, The Motley Fool AU or TMF Scott P. Follow us, like us. We throw some stuff out there on Twitter regularly. We get a chance to interact with you, and we love your questions, comments, feedback, suggestions. What else? That's about it. Funny memes.
Yeah.
Be kind. Yeah. I got flamed on Twitter this week for criticizing short sellers.
I'm short shorts.
I don't resolve them for my criticism, by the way, but it was an ugly couple of days. So if you want to see somebody get piled on for having an unpopular view, feel free to have a look back through my Twitter account. You'll see some of that. All right, mate. On to the mailbag episode.
Let's do it.
But in the meantime, that wraps us up. So until Sunday, don't forget you can subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, we hope you do because you made it this far, leave us a review, leave us a rating, give us some stars. It helps us rise up the rankings a little bit, which makes us feel good ego-wise, but also helps other people find the podcast. And hey, who doesn't need a little bit more foolishness in their lives?
Everyone needs it.
Go to www.fool.com.au/Triple M.
Triple M.
That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll see you Sunday with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/triple M. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.